The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
All right.
Good morning.
Okay, let's get into it. So, do I need the mic? Yeah, probably. Yes. Okay. So, we have a white nationalist regime in the White House, and we have a president who uses fascist language, referring to immigrants as animals, invaders, and infestation as breeders, right? This is fascist language. So the rise of far-right organizations and the hard-right turn of the Trump administration have led to more discussion about the dangers of fascism and how to fight it. In our movements, when people talk about fascism, they might be referring to repressive police tactics, authoritarian policies promoted by the government, or racist scapegoating. And under capitalism, these kind of policies can exist under many different types of regimes, from a hard right government to more liberal governments. But fascism is a very specific historical phenomenon which must be diagnosed carefully in order to fight it correctly. What are the circumstances that bring fascism about? What is the social base it relies on? What gives it strength and what are its weaknesses? and we can make big errors in strategy if we either overestimate or underestimate our enemy. For more on fighting the right today, there is a talk in the next session, I think it's in this room, on what will it take to defeat the far right. But in this talk, I'm going to look at the origins of fascism in the early 20th century, how two of the clearest theorists in the communist movement analyzed it and developed a strategy to fight back, and why our side failed to stop fascism and the horrors that it brought. Although our context is very different today, I think this gives us the key principles that we need to build an effective movement and prevent the victory of fascism in the future. So fascism started in post-World War I Italy. In 1919, Mussolini organized the Fasci di Combattimento, or Italian Combat Leagues, as a reaction against the growing working class movement that threatened to overthrow capitalism. As in many countries after World War I, Italian workers were inspired by the Russian Revolution, and in 1920, over 500,000 workers took over their factories. Poor peasants took over land, and soldiers stopped obeying orders. Unfortunately, the unions, leaders and the Italian Reformist Socialist Party did not believe in turning this struggle into a revolution and directed the workers to leave their factories in exchange for a series of promised improvements that never materialized. The failure of this factory occupation movement demoralized the working class and laid the basis for the fascist reaction. With the argument that socialists were anti-nationals trying to weaken the state, Mussolini's League carried out what they called punitive expeditions, basically smashing anything linked to the Socialist Party. They killed several thousand Socialist Party leaders and activists. Fascism quickly became a mass movement, and in 1922, Mussolini became prime minister, where he banned and smashed all workers' organizations. Encouraged by his success, similar movements arose in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, and most importantly, Germany. So figuring out what fascism was and how to fight it was a challenge for the left. This was a new phenomenon. The Communist International took up the discussion at its congresses in 1922 and 23. The Comintern was founded after the Russian Revolution, and it was a gathering of communist parties to discuss how to overthrow capitalism in more countries around the world. Clara Zetkin was the key leader in this effort. In 1923, at the Congress, she was 66 years old. She had joined the German socialist movement when she was 21. Forced out of Germany due to anti-socialist laws, she was a leader in the socialist women's movement and in the establishment of International Women's Day in 1910. When the German Social Democratic Party betrayed its principles and supported World War I in 1914, She joined Rosa Luxemburg in quitting the party to form the Spartacus League, which became the German Communist Party. And I just want to pause and encourage everybody to get this book. I had read Trotsky's writings on fascism before, but I actually had no idea that someone in the communist movement had put forward such a clear analysis at such an early stage in the rise of fascism. It was like 7 years before Trotsky's best known writings on the topic. And she fought literally until her death to stop the rise of fascism. It's a huge contribution to Marxism. So what is fascism? In her speech to the Comintern, Zetkin sought to explain how fascism was a new and historically specific phenomenon. So we know that fascism is characterized by extreme nationalism and uses racist scapegoating to divert blame for the crisis away from the ruling class and divide the working class. We know that fascists relied on shock troops and using violence to destroy their opposition. I want to focus on three characteristics that Zetkin drew out that I think are least understood but have big implications for how we fight back. The first one is that fascism is a result of the economic crisis of capitalism, a crisis so acute that the regular bourgeois state institutions can't resolve it. And the ruling class seeks to restore profitability by smashing the most basic organizations of the working class. She wrote, "Fascism is rooted in the dissolution of the capitalist economy and the bourgeois state. World War I shattered capitalism to its foundations. This is evident not only in the appalling impoverishment of the proletariat, but also in the proletarianization of very broad petty bourgeois and middle bourgeois masses. To respond to the crisis and under the pressure of this mass workers movement, this is why the fascists initially use anti-capitalist rhetoric at the beginning, and why the Nazis called themselves National Socialists, to exploit workers' anger and then divert it toward nationalism. But once in power, Zetkin pointed out that fascism becomes a bureaucracy and tends to abandon any populist or anti-capitalist appeals. The understanding that fascism comes out of capitalist crisis is critical because to fight fascism, we not only need to expose why their solution to the crisis is wrong, we have to offer a way out of capitalist crisis as well. Second thing that she emphasized is that unlike other forms of reaction and counter-revolution that were led by a small caste of military generals, fascism is a movement of broad masses of people. She said it sweeps along broad masses who have lost security of their existence. So we know that the ruling class who actually own and control the economy are a tiny group of people, right? In the US, statistically, literally 1%. And it's not, they're not big enough to crush the working class on their own, especially if that class is highly organized and active, right? Such as following those near revolutions in Europe. So fascism is based on mobilizing the middle layers between them and the working class, which Marxists often call the petty bourgeoisie. So these are intellectuals, small business people, managers, small farmers. And Zetkin said they vacillate indecisively between the powerful historical camps of the proletariat and bourgeoisie. So they don't have the power of the capitalists that comes from owning the means of production, owning everything. And they don't have the potential collective power of the working class to shut down production and withhold our labor. So they can be pulled into alliance with whichever of the two major classes seems to have a solution to the crisis. She says the conditions of the middle layers have worsened markedly in every country. As a result, there are countless thousands seeking new possibilities for survival, food security, and social standing. And although they don't have the social power of the working class, we need to win over, you know, these middle layers of people to the side of the revolution. Zetkin gives the example of, like in the Russian Revolution, the role of intellectuals who could either be on board or after the revolution tried to sabotage the success of it. The third thing she emphasized was that this came about in Italy and Germany because of the failure of the working class to solve the crisis, the failure of the left to provide a decisive solution. And first of all, this was because of the role of the reformists. How many of you guys went to the meeting on the German Revolution? Anyone? So you got that that full explanation there. She says, from the perspective of like the middle layers in Germany, in Italy, she was describing, the socialists promised an easing of our burdens and suffering, but the top dogs and the rich carry on and rule with even more severity than before. But also, it was because the revolutionary movement was unable to go beyond the reformists to take over the system and create a new one. As a result, these middle layers lost faith that the working class could be the force to change society. She says, the intermediate layers are induced to sympathize with the proletariat by their life suffering, and in part by their soul's noble longings and high ideals, so long as it is not only revolutionary in its conduct, but seems to have prospects for victory. But when it becomes clear that the proletariat itself has abandoned the goal of carrying the revolution further, at this point, the broad fascist masses find their way to the spot where most of their leaders always were, on the side of the bourgeoisie. So I think from these characteristics, there are some important conclusions she draws about how to stop fascism. The first is the importance of an ideological struggle to win over the working class, that we have a solution, that the working class is the solution, but also to win over as much of those middle layer people as possible. She says in Italy, the communists, quote, made a policy error in viewing fascism solely as a military phenomenon and overlooking its ideological and political side. So they thought you could kind of fight it militarily with small groups of people, and they didn't put out an argument about why their solution's wrong and we have a better one. Small halting reforms would not inspire the kind of confidence necessary to win people over. And then I just want to read you a quote about that. Don't worry about that. In my view, she says, it is extremely important that we purposefully and consistently carry out the ideological and political struggle for the souls of those in these layers, including the bourgeois intelligentsia. We must understand that incontestably growing masses here are seeking an escape route from the dreadful suffering of our time. This involves much more than filling one's stomach. No, the best of them are seeking an escape from deep anguish of the soul. They're longing for new and unshakable ideals and a world outlook that enables them to understand nature, society, and their own life. Hold on one second. We must go to them with conviction and understanding for their condition and their fiery longing, work among them and show them a solution that does not lead backward but rather forward to communism. The overriding grandeur of communism as a world outlook will win their sympathies for us. And I'll come back to that. So obviously, this also leads to the need to organize mass working class fight back. And she says a quote that I think is helpful for our situation today. She says, we must not combat fascism in the way of the reformists in Italy, who beseech them to leave me alone and I'll leave you alone. On the contrary, meet violence with violence, but not violence in the form of individual terror. That will surely fail. But rather violence as the power of the revolutionary organized proletarian class struggle. And she argued that the need for this kind of mass fight back means that we need an alliance of all working class forces committed to fighting fascism, regardless of their ideology. And this is what the United Front means. Fascism's goal is to smash the working class and all of our organizations. So we need the largest possible force for self-defense, encompassing everyone that wants to fight it. She says, Proletarian struggle and self-defense against fascism requires a proletarian united front. Fascism does not ask if the worker in the factory has a soul painted in the white and blue colors of Bavaria, or is inspired by the black, red, and gold colors of the bourgeois republic, or by the red banner with a hammer and sickle. It does not ask whether the worker wants to restore the dynasty of Bavaria, is a fan of Ebert, the social democrat, or would rather see a German Soviet republic. All that matters to fascism is that they encounter a class-conscious proletarian and they club him to the ground. That is why workers must come together for struggle without distinctions of party or trade union affiliation. And so lastly, as discussed before, defeating fascism doesn't just require fight back, but the ability to provide a left alternative for how to solve capitalism's crisis with a socialist society. And so for that reason, within the United Front, it was critical to have clear politics in the form of a revolutionary party. Reading a lot of quotes. Still need to get the book. We must maintain our communist ideology in all its strength and clarity, she said. The more we go to the masses, the more important it is for the Communist Party to be organizationally and ideologically unified. So this argument was convincing to the Comintern, and in the 1923 Congress, they adopted her resolution on fighting fascism, which laid out the need for communist parties in every country to create united fronts against fascism. Quote, made up of workers' parties and organizations of every viewpoint. She talked about, she listed their tasks, right? All right, go out, create a united front. You have to research the fascist movement. You need an education campaign for the working class and for middle class layers of people. You need self-defense struggles in the factories and workplaces. And then any positions you have in unions, parliament, you use those to denounce fascism's danger. And this is 1923. If that approach had been adopted, fascism in Germany could have been stopped, I think. People should say what they think. And so I'm gonna turn to Germany. In 1928, Germany had, and throughout the 20s and earlier, Germany had the biggest organized workers' movement in the world, with 5 million workers in unions, 1 million members of the Social Democratic Party, the Reformist Party, and 130,000 members of the revolutionary KPD, the Communist Party, which was led by Luxembourg and Liebknecht. The country went through 3 economic crises in 12 years. So after World War I, after losing World War I, just like in Italy, there were strikes, mutinies, and demonstrations. They overthrew the monarchy. And like in Italy, the reformists had a majority in the councils and eventually dissolved them in favor of a bourgeois republic. In that context, the communists, the KPD, called for a general strike, which brought 500,000 people into the streets, but they didn't have the organizational strength to turn it into a revolution. The reformists then, to restore order, used the army and these new militias called the Freikorps, which kind of morphed into the Nazis later, who arrested, tortured, and murdered Luxembourg and Liebknecht. In 1923, Germany again went into crisis because of the debt repayments that the Allies were asking for. That's when people might know the German currency became worthless. People were like using it as wallpaper and stuff. There was complete disillusionment with the status quo. And the communists at this point, maybe having, you know, demoralized and burned from before, they ignored the crisis, and then they called for an uprising without preparing people, and then at the last minute they called it off. So again, more people became disillusioned with the revolutionary left. They were like unable to solve the crisis. So the Nazis in Germany were also based in the petty bourgeoisie. They grew disproportionately in rural areas and towns where the working class was smallest. In urban areas, they did grow in urban areas, mostly among young unemployed small business owners. They also started with an element of anti-capitalism, as I mentioned, hence their name, but then refocused middle-class discontent on Jewish people and the working class itself. And then the third economic crisis hit in Germany after the Wall Street crash in the US in 29. And because American currency had been partly keeping Germany afloat, there was another huge crash. The centrist government fell apart, and in the 1930 elections, the communist vote went up by 40%, but the Nazi vote went up by 800%. So, I mean, the danger is clear and present, right, in Germany. And, you know, think about it. They've seen the example of Italy, right? They've been able to benefit from this analysis, right, that, like, there is a way to fight back. But they still did not develop a united front approach to fighting fascism. A year after, and why? A year after this was passed in the Comintern, it was overturned. During the next few years, the Comintern came increasingly under the domination of the bureaucracy headed by Stalin. Although its position on the united front went back and forth for a while, it never went back to this clear position that Zetkin had outlined. Thank you. I think I'll be all right, hopefully. And by 1928, the Stalin-controlled Comintern adopted a sectarian approach, which was actually the opposite of the United Front, that they were opposed to any kind of anti-fascist unity with social democrats and other non-communist organizations in the workers' movement, who they actually called social fascists. A quote from the KPD newspaper in Germany at that time, they said, "Fascism is the military organization of the bourgeoisie which leans on the social democracy for active support. The social democracy, objectively speaking, is the moderate wing of fascism." Okay? So you get this impression that they're just all part of the same thing. So just to quickly speak on Trotsky, people know probably by now. He was one of the key leaders of the Russian Revolution alongside Lenin and was forced out of Russia because of his criticisms of the rising Stalinist bureaucracy. So during these years, okay, like think about the anguish Trotsky's going through. From 1929 to 33, he was exiled on the Turkish island of Principe under constant surveillance by Turkish authorities. He couldn't get information. Like, he was like, I can't get newspapers on time. And he couldn't get his writings out. It was like very difficult for him to get his writings out. But he was putting all his efforts into trying to get the communist parties in Europe to wage the kind of struggle that could have stopped the Nazis. So he argued that this social fascist analysis would be disastrous. Lumping social democrats and all bourgeois parties in with fascism actually meant you were not taking the danger of fascism seriously, right? Fascism means annihilating all workers' organizations, making future resistance extremely difficult, right? And it's like, if there's already a form of fascism in power, what's the urgency of fighting the new kind of fascism, right? He argued that the Stalinists' fear of working in united front with reformists was actually a cover for extreme passivity and unwillingness to build a fighting movement. I don't know if you guys have heard this metaphor that he used. He said, a cattle dealer once drove some bulls to the slaughterhouse, and the butcher came nigh with his sharp knife. "Let us close ranks and jack up this executioner on our horns," suggested one of the bulls. "If you please, in what way is the butcher any worse than the dealer who drove us here with his cudgel?" replied the bulls, who believed in social fascism. "But we'll be able to deal with the dealer as well afterwards." "Nothing doing," replied the bulls, firm in their principles, to the counselor. "You're trying from the left to shield our enemies. You're a social butcher yourself." And they refused to close ranks. So for the communists to be over here saying, oh, they're all the same, it actually drove more people to the reformists, because they were like, because it didn't make sense. And the KPD goes back and forth, if you read their newspaper, between like overestimating the Nazis, like, oh my God, they're already way too powerful, and then underestimating them, that like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. Both of those approaches mean you're gonna be passive, right? Like they're too powerful for us, or like, oh, it's not a big deal. And basically, like, think about it, millions of workers are part of the reformist SPD. And instead of trying to win them over, the KPD is basically insulting them. So they said, we must ruthlessly purge the ranks of the proletariat in factory and trade union of all rotten elements. He who belongs to the SPD is rotten and has to go. So at a time when you need mass working class forces to fight the fascists, they're trying to drive people out of the unions for being reformist. Makes no sense. This stuff gets really tragic, you guys. So they're seeing, they start to see their own electoral losses as the communists. They see that they're failing, but they don't believe in uniting with broader forces to fight the Nazis. So what does that leave you with, right? By 1931, they're basically accepting Hitler's victory as inevitable. They said, once the Nazis are in power, the united front of the proletariat will arise and make a clean sweep of everything. We're not afraid of the fascist gentlemen. They will shoot their bolt quicker than any other government. Like, they'll get in power, it's not gonna be a big deal, then we'll have a united front and fight them. Trotsky's trying very hard to like expose this. So one thing he says is like, the united front is not just a defensive tactic, it's also a way that we're gonna win people over to people that are not yet revolutionary, over to being revolutionary. And it does go back to the fact that in capitalism, right, the consciousness of the working class is gonna be mixed, and yet we want workers to emancipate themselves, right? So you have to be in a joint struggle to win people to revolutionary ideas. The Stalinist approach, and this, people will refer to it as the third period, the period of Stalinist policy where it was all sectarian. It basically said that, you know, the communists would give more credibility to the reformists by uniting with them. And so we should just denounce them from the sidelines. So Trotsky went back to the same things that Zetkin had said, right? When we're being threatened as a working class, people want unity for power, for self-defense. And if the revolutionaries are over here just being like, those people suck, you know, they don't get it. They're seen as splitting and weakening the movement when it needs to be strong. Secondly, the large majority of the working class were in reformist organizations because they had not yet been convinced that the revolutionaries were effective. In order to be one, they would need to see the communists as leaders in an effective campaign of action. Trotsky was constantly being like called a reformist and a sellout and a Menshevik and all this stuff by the Stalinists. They called him a counter-revolutionary. But he argued the best way to critique and expose the bankruptcy of the reformists was to challenge them to work together in a united front, allow people to compare their tactics and revolutionary tactics in practice. If the reformists refused to work with the revolutionaries, which the SPD did in a lot of cases, then it would show they weren't really serious about fighting fascism. And if they did work together, people would be able to compare the two approaches. The communists are always seeking to increase worker self-empowerment and take the movement as far as it can go, and that would show itself to be the best way to fight. And this also meant some people were like, okay, well, we'll get the working masses to be in a united front with us, but we won't work with reformist leaders, right? And he's like, people aren't gonna go for that, right? The reason they're reformists is they follow those leaders, so call out those leaders, be like, let's do it, united front. And, you know, then people will come along and get to see the differences. In response to being called a reformist, Trotsky was like, hey, you know the Soviets were a united front. Like, the workers' councils that took power in the Russian Revolution, that was not just one party. That was actually the Bolsheviks fighting for power in a mixed political environment that represented the whole class taking power. So, like, we don't get to just be on our own, like, even after the revolution. It's a fight for ideas. Just really quickly, what am I at? Okay. I'll try to speed up. Yeah, he also emphasized, you know how Zetkin had said, you know, the more we go out to a broad front, the more important it is that we have clear politics. He said the same thing. People sometimes say march separately in our own contingent, strike together, right? And if at any point the reformists tried to seriously stop the struggle, then the communists, have their own contingent and they can continue the struggle. They reserve the right to do that. So, as I mentioned, the failure to create this united front on the part of both the reformists and the revolutionaries is what opened the door for Hitler taking power. And when he became chancellor in 1933, his first act was to create a special police force to arrest communists and socialists from the SPD. Even the communists that were elected to parliament were arrested and not allowed to take their seats. And German unions were dissolved in December of 1933. So really quick, my question when I read this stuff was like, how does that benefit anyone for them to have that sectarian policy? Like, why did that happen? And so just really quick, I'm sure people in the discussion can share more. It came from the needs of the Stalinist bureaucracy that was by that time controlling what the Comintern did. It's also understand, think about if your leaders like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were murdered, and you know the reformist social SPD was like behind that, was cool with it. Like, I think Trotsky says after that there was like blood between the reformists and the revolutionaries in Germany. You can understand that. But Trotsky gave the example of in the Russian Revolution, there was a military dictator, Kornilov, that came along at a time when it was dual power. There was a reformist government and the Soviets were still fighting for power. And a military dictator came along, you know, to restore the Tsar or a dictatorship. And you know, those reformists, the government of Kerensky, had totally gone after the Bolsheviks, imprisoned their leaders, forced them underground, like totally repressed them. But they didn't say, oh, screw you, let the military dictator come on in, right? The Bolsheviks got behind the movement to stop the dictatorship. And they said, we'll deal with him first, Kornilov, the guy trying to do a military coup, and then we'll take on this reformist, right, that wants to repress us. So it's not an excuse. The reformists done a lot of betrayals, but it's not an excuse to not build the united front. The Stalinists had tried to ally with non-working class forces in both Britain and China, and it had been like a dismal, like they had totally turned their back on the communist movement. So this was kind of like a shift in the other direction, like, okay, screw it, like we're not gonna work with any allies. And it had to do also with Stalin's approach to what was happening inside Russia. He was turning, now that he believed, you know, he had won this idea of socialism in one country, we're gonna industrialize Russia and make it economically strong, screw everyone else. And that meant he was about to go after the peasants and he was about to force collectivization of agriculture. So he basically had this new approach that was like, you know, we don't need any allies. We don't need any other class allies. We don't need any other party allies. And that led to the sectarianism, but other people can probably help explain that as well. So just to conclude about the meaning for today, and again, please go to the next session as well on more about how we fight the right, but I think we certainly have an economic crisis today and a social crisis that is leading to deep attacks on workers and the oppressed and sharpening polarization. We do not yet have a mass fascist movement, right? Obviously, we haven't had a failed workers' revolution, and we don't have a mass fascist movement. However, the forces that want to bring that about are organizing, right? And Trump is giving them cover. They are growing under his protection, right? I don't know if people saw the video from Portland. I think Alex shared it about Patriot Prayer, like moving in formation to attack the left in street fights in Portland, and they're like training themselves to do that, right? There, as people know, there's a national campaign to bring far-right speakers to campuses to attack socialists, abortion rights, and anti-racist ideas. And then you have like powerful organizations like the NRA. I'm probably due like another 4 minutes. Encouraging a violent response to the left, right? I think you know, one of the things I got out of this framework is like the importance of not over or underestimating enemies, like having the right analysis of their forces. I think one of the things people have seen is that people that say we're already living in fascism sometimes use that as an excuse to say why we need to vote Democrat, right? Or like why we should trust the FBI to like help bring down the Trump administration, right? So obviously that's, and saying we already have fascism can also miss the continuities between the last administration and this one, the way that the Democrats' policies laid the basis for Trump. However, when people talk about fascism right now, I don't see that as like, oh my God, they're too powerful, we can't do anything. I see that as people saying, this is urgent. Like, let us get out there and build this movement, and we need to do that. And even though we do not have mass reformist parties like the SPD or like the kind of union influence that they had, the United Front is still the best way to do it. So go back to Zetkin's quote where she said, let's not be like the reformists and say, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, right? And let's not go after them with little forces, right? We need mass working class forces. So I just wanted to call out how inspired I was by the demonstrations in both Boston and Berkeley, where they systematically went to every union in their city, to every reformist organization, to every liberal group and said, get on board, be part of this demonstration, we need a mass turnout. And within that, you can see that the revolutionaries got a hearing. People were like, yeah, they know what they're talking about. And then I also think this piece about how we are fighting for, we're fighting for the majority of the working class. Like, even fighting for people who've been pulled to the right, because our goal is, you know, a revolution. And I think that's reflected in how we're not dismissive of like, oh, red state, like all those people suck, right? And we've actually seen how something like a teacher strike in a state where a lot of those people may have voted for Trump actually shifted people, shifted consciousness, because it was about a solution. How do we solve the crisis that we're in a collective left-wing way? And then lastly, as people, okay, I'm gonna read this and then read a quote and then I'm gonna be done. The last thing that led to fascism was that the left wasn't sufficiently well organized to achieve its own solution to capitalist crisis. That is a revolution to bring about a worker-run democratic economy to meet human needs. The question of whether we will be able to do that is still in the future, but organizing the strongest and largest possible revolutionary left to increase our chances of success is something that cannot wait. And I just want to end with, my God, Zetkin, in 1932, okay, 32 in Germany, she was elected as a communist to the Reichstag, to the parliament. And this is the parliament in 1932 where it was full of Nazi deputies in their uniforms. I think that the Nazis had like half or more of the parliament that she's getting up. Because she was the most veteran member of parliament, she got the ability to give the opening speech to Congress that session. And it says, Zetkin was very weak. She was 77. Subject to fainting fits and almost blind. Before a Reichstag crammed with Nazi deputies, two communist deputies helped her mount the speaker's platform. She spoke at first with a barely audible voice, but little by little her voice strengthened and grew passionate. And she's speaking to this room. And she says, our most urgent task today is to form a united front of all working people in order to turn back fascism. All the differences that divide and shackle us, whether founded on political, trade union, religious, or ideological outlooks, must give way before this imperious historical necessity. All those who are menaced, all those who suffer, all those who desire freedom must join the united front against fascism and its representatives in government. Working people must assert themselves against fascism. That is the urgent and indispensable precondition for a united front against economic crisis, imperialist war on its causes, and the capitalist mode of production.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.